Well, one of the, and we are going to put our focus here today on our mission, on getting the truth about Oscar Grant, about fighting for justice for Oscar, about fighting for justice for all the victims of police murder, and stopping this epidemic of police brutality and murder, and really getting at the truth of this. And, you know, that's what we're here for. And one of the reasons that we say this epidemic is rooted in the very workings of the system is because of instances we just heard. Here's an officer that has murdered someone already and is still on the force. This happens over and over again. We got a statement, the media has been telling us that Johannes Mescherle is a nice guy, he plays the guitar, blah, blah, blah. Well, we have a statement from Kenneth Carruthers, who couldn't come here today. I'm going to read the statement later. But he was brutalized by Mescherle. Has this been on the front page of the newspapers? This happened before the murder of Oscar Grant. We've got the example that Robin just told us about. There's even an example of an Oakland police, an Oakland cop, Ed Paulson, kicked Andrew Amaro in the chest and killed him. And he was promoted to captain and made head of internal affairs. That's the division that's supposed to correct wrongdoing. This happens over and over again. Who's the character witness for Mescherle? Tony Peroni, who started this whole mess and could have been charged with felony murder. If anybody in this room had been, you know, in a situation with other people they knew and something had happened, all of us would have been rounded up. We know this. So that tells us. What about Gregory Sir? He was the supervising police who killed Danny's brother, Mark Garcia. He's being considered for police chief. This tells you right now what Danny said in his talk, what our article said in Revolution, and people have, this is a cold, bitter truth to confront, but it's true that we live in an oppressive system and it's backed up by violence. And I'd like to now, again, we've got a lot more important witnesses, and we're going to hear from all the witnesses who have come today. All of this is going to be videotaped and audiotaped. Everything people are saying here today is going to be known to many more people. But next, I would like to call up Clyde Young of the Revolutionary Communist Party to help us put this in, paint a picture for us. Clyde, thank you. Clyde, why don't you just begin and tell us, you know, I wanted to talk some about this criminalization of youth and the generation that we've been, that a number of people have referred to, and the Zaporia testified about. What, you know, what have you learned about this, including from your own life? And
yeah. Well, first of all, I have to say, and I'm sure everyone here which shares this same opinion, that you have nothing but a heavy heart when you listen to these stories. And when you realize what makes it even more, you know, what makes it worse is that when you realize that a lot of these killings, all of them, most of them, were not necessary. And in fact, you know, just think about being afraid for your kid to go out and get a meal for fear that he or she might be killed. And it's important to recognize that there are women, young girls up there who have been killed also. And it just points to the nature of this system. In terms of my own experience, I'll just speak briefly about that. You know, I was a kid who came up in the system, you know, for the first half of my life. I spent many years locked up, beginning at 9 years old, where I was arrested for shoplifting. And this is the sort of thing that they would normally just take you home to your parents and have your parents punish you for that. But instead of that happening in my case, a young black kid, only 19 years old, I was taken downtown to the city lockup. And that was my first experience with actually being locked up. I was 9 years old. And I was locked up there until my parents came and got me. And after that, I was arrested at 12 years old and subsequently incarcerated in a youth authority. And that went on until I was 15 years old. I was incarcerated in that way for mostly minor offenses. Things, again, that would just require your parents to discipline you and send you home. But to go further and tell you more, when I was in prison for 20 years, and I was 17 years old, not long after I was in there, I was involved in a protest. And it's long ago, and I can't remember exactly what all the demands were, but they were about prison conditions and some other things. So we were protesting out on what we call the drill ground, but it was actually a recreation yard. And we laid down on the ground when the guards came with shotguns, because we figured if we weren't doing anything that they wouldn't shoot us. And this had been sparked by, you know, prison conditions, and we had actually been protesting throughout that day. But when the guards came with guns, we laid down on the drill ground. That is, with the exception of one person who didn't lay down. And we were angry because of the conditions that we were confronting and because of the way we were forced to live in there, where they have absolute control over your entire life and tell you when to eat and when to sleep and everything else. So the guards came and they said, "We're going to give you boys 5 minutes to leave." And of course, given our commitment to what we were protesting about, and given our anger, we of course refused to leave. And then after the 5 minutes expired, they opened fire on us, killing 2 and wounding 47. And at that time, it reminded me of a scene from Vietnam. But this is the nature of what this system does to you when you dare rise up and do anything in opposition to it. But later after that, I was transferred to another prison shortly after that. And one of the things that actually turned me completely to being a revolutionary was the fact when they killed Fred Hampton, sleeping in his bed. And it was not long after this incident that I've described to you, which we in the prison at that time referred to as a massacre. Here, prisoners lying on the ground, unarmed, not non-threatening, and they come in and they actually come in to teach us a lesson. And the lesson was never to rise up and try to do anything to protest us, even if you're doing that non-violently, because we'll strike you down. So that's the lesson I got that day.
You know, this what you're talking about, prison, you know, there's now 2 billion young men in prison. There's the highest incarceration rate in the whole world in this country. I believe the figure is 1 in 9 black men is tied up in the so-called justice system. I'd like you to talk, compare today to, you know, when you were coming up. It sounds like today it may be even worse. So maybe you could talk about that and what you think the roots of this are and how you understand why this is happening to us.
Yes. Well, I think it is worse today than when I was a kid, although at that time, from the stories that I've actually just, you know, talked about, it's clear that it wasn't these kinds of things went on. But I think when you try to get to the roots of this, you have to go back to the late 50s and the early 60s, where major changes were going on in the country and where they actually moved much of the industry out of the inner cities. When I was growing up in the 1950s, there was a lot of industry in the inner cities. But they moved a lot of that industry out of the inner cities into the suburbs and in many cases to other parts of the world. And this was something that was going on in the 1960s, where the economic system was actually doing better. But this became a hemorrhage in the 1970s when the system was in crisis, and where you find that a lot of the industries that were formerly in the inner cities have now been, as I said, moved either into the suburbs or been moved abroad. And a lot of this has to do because of the defiance of people in the inner cities, blacks, Latinos. I think there's concern about employers actually hiring them. And that has something to do with these jobs actually being moved out of the cities. In fact, they're concerned, and many reports and many studies have been conducted where blacks go in and apply for a job, and your name can be something that keeps you from getting that job. Or where you live. Like if you sign on the application that I live in Cabrini Green in Chicago, you can forget about that job. You're not going to get that job. But to take this further and quickly, you know, that this has led under Nixon. And I'd like to read just a small part from our newspaper here about the 1970s, when essentially it said, and this is a newspaper, the issue of the newspaper is called "The Oppression of Black People, the Crimes of the System, and the Revolution We Need." And it's quoted in this article that in 1969, H.R. Haldeman, Nixon's top assistant, wrote in his diary that President Nixon emphasized that you have to face the fact that the whole system, that you have to face the fact that the whole problem is the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes that while not appearing to. This thus gave rise to the war on drugs. Now you have a situation on the one hand in these inner cities where you have large numbers of blacks and Latinos where they have no prospect of ever getting a job. In fact, you have a large section of permanently unemployed youth. And the point is not to justify the kinds of things that they get caught up in. But an author of a book called Turbo Capitalism once wrote that for many of these youth in the inner cities, crime is a rational choice. When you consider everything, when you consider the possibility that they may be sent to prison, and this, I must add, was a conservative commentary. This was no revolutionary that made this comment. He said that crime for many of these youth is a rational choice when you consider all the options that are in front of them. And so this actually points to, in other words, since the 1970s and accelerating through the 80s, there's actually been a war, and more than that, a whole criminalization of a generation of youth. In fact, when we started an organization, or we were part of an organization back in the 1990s that was called, it was a coalition against police brutality, one of the themes of that organization was to oppose the criminalization of a whole generation.
Okay. One of the things, and I appreciate this, because one of the things we're trying to do with this tribunal is go from right down on the ground with Oscar Graham to see the bigger picture and the whole system and these patterns in history and affecting the whole country and what the roots of this are. And as Clyde's describing in capitalism. And maybe you could conclude by touching on a couple of things. Professor Woods mentioned this, other people have mentioned this terrorizing of people and the comparison of police murder to lynching. And then, quickly tell us, does it have to be this way? It's been this way, if Danny was saying this for 200 years, he's right. Does it have to be this way?
Well, I left out a statistic that I wanted to share with you, and that is between 1967 and 1987, in four cities in this country, in Philadelphia, New York, and Detroit, those cities taken together lost 1 million jobs. And this is a trend that's actually continued and accelerated in the decades since that time. So there's a DVD by Bob Avakian called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And in that DVD, he starts with an actually chilling exposure of lynching. And he talks about many people being lynched for nothing at all. If you've seen the movie, it's called, I think, The Great Debaters, where these kids are out on the road and they encounter someone being lynched and they want to know why that person's being lynched. And the person's being lynched essentially for no reason at all. But this lynching at that time was a means of enforcing the condition that black people were in sharecropping, or another way of putting it, a new book that's come out that talks about slavery by another name, that they were actually in a form of slavery during that period. And after the Civil War, and I'll be very brief on this, but I think it's an important point. After the Civil War, or after Reconstruction, I should say, many of the officers that were on the side of the Confederacy actually were crucial in forming the KKK, the Ku Klux Klan. And what Avakian goes on to identify in this tape, and I would encourage all of you to get a hold of it and try to see this part and to see the whole thing, because it's very searing indictment of the system about lynching. But over 5,000 people were lynched, you know, in that period of Reconstruction. And Avakian talks about how lynching at that time was used as a means for not only enforcing the oppression that was going on back then, but also to spread fear. And I had something I just wanted to briefly read that was published in our newspaper in an article by a person called Malcolm Shore. And he says in there, and he quotes Avakian as saying, after tracing the rivers of blood that fed the ocean of American history, and we should not forget for one moment, when they want to talk about the greatness of this country, that was founded on two things: the near extermination of the native people were here and the enslavement of black people. That's the glorious history of America. But he goes on to talk about, after angrily recounting some of the most horrific instances of lynching that occurred in the United States on U.S. soil, Avakian quoted an author who had written a book about the subject, saying, quote, "It is doubtful that any black male growing up in the rural South in that period of the 1900s to 1940 was not traumatized by the fear of being lynched." And he goes further to say that today it is mostly the police who are openly at the police, because back then you had both unofficial terror and you had official terror. And many of these lynchings, in some cases, they were conducted in the daylight, they were conducted at dark, but many times they were actually carnivals where people came with their lunches. The press came to witness it. And Dylan wrote a song where he's talking about they had postcards for the hanging, because many of these hangings were actually photographed, and those postcards were shared with people throughout the country who weren't there. So today it is mostly the police who openly, as the police, carry out brutality and terror against black youth and black people in general, and I would add also against Latinos and others. Avakian said, applying that author's statement to lynching to the present, we could put it this way. It is doubtful that there is a young black man or a young black male growing up in the U.S. today, in the South or the North, who does not have a very real fear of being brutalized and even murdered by the police. And one of the things that's so frightening about it is that it's so arbitrary. It can happen at any time and for any reason. You could be coming home, as Oscar Grant was, from a celebration on New Year's. And who would know that you would actually be killed on your way home? So the arbitrariness of this kind of thing is also what leads to the fear that it spreads.
Thanks. And if you could just wrap it up with, does it have to be like this?
Yes. Thank you. I forgot that part. No, it does not have. Yes, thanks. It does not have to be this way. And in fact, you know, we have to go so far as to understand, while it's very necessary to, I mean, ultimately this, if you look at this, and I could stand here all day and talk about the crimes of this system as I've talked about some of them. These things are actually integral to this system. The oppression, this near genocide against Native Americans, and the enslavement of black people in this country, and these crimes go on today where people are forced from their homelands in Mexico into this country to search for jobs because their economy has been actually upset and distorted by the U.S. And then they're actually pitted against black people and saying that they're taking the jobs of black people, where they're just oppressed just like black people are, and they're pitting people against one another. And this is one of the things that we're up against. But ultimately, these problems cannot be solved unless we do away with this system entirely. To give you an example of that, there was a young woman who was sitting in her car. She was unconscious. Her name was Taisha Miller. This was some years ago. She was sitting in her car. She was unconscious. So the police surrounded the car. And what did they do? Did they knock on the door? Did they try to get her out in a nonviolent fashion? No. They riddled her with blood, with bullets. In fact, when I first talked to one of the family members, they said that one of the things in the leaflet that we had put out at that time that stood out to them was the fact that they shot this woman unnecessarily and riddled her body. I can't remember how many bullets, but you all know that they don't stop with just one. But what kind of situation is this? These people say that they're serving and protecting the people, but this is how they're serving and protecting the people, by shooting people down in the way that they did Tyesha Miller. Well, one thing I'll tell you in answer to your question is that things don't have to be this way. And under a system in which, under a socialist society, which we would fight to bring into being, this kind of thing would not happen. Not only that, but in a similar situation, a police officer of the people would be willing to risk their own lives rather than to commit the kind of crime that they committed against Tyesha Miller. What this shows, that this system itself needs to be pushed off the pages of history, and a whole new society should be brought into being where people can flourish, where you don't have to have the fear of your son growing too big, where you don't have to have the fear of your kid going outside at night to get a meal and then finding out that he shot 6 times in the back on his way back home. We don't need this kind of world, and in fact, we don't always have to have this kind of world. We need a revolution to get rid of this kind of society. But right now, we need a revolution, but right now we need a revolutionary movement with the Revolution newspaper at the center of it. And at the same time, we need to be raising political consciousness and organizing people. And yes, we need to be resisting the things that they do, where they come into these communities where these youth have a death sentence on them and they shoot them down for no reason at all. That needs to be resisted as part of the movement to build a revolution. Thank you.
Thank you, Clyde. And I want to give some recognition here. We talked about the genocide against Native Americans. Native Americans are still being killed by the police. The Andrew Maupin family has been on the front lines of this struggle. They were not able to come tonight, but Sonia Wadney has lost 3 of her family to police brutality and this and different sorts of violence in this society. Coralie Simmons, who's the mother of Leonard Acorn Peters, who was killed some years ago, couldn't come but sends her regards. And we've got other statements and witnesses as well. One of the things that I, again, bringing it back to Oscar Grant and what's happened in the wake of it, and our next witness has a long experience with this sort of a thing. One of the most bitter things about families who've lost loved ones is the stone wall of lies, of injustice, of lack of action, of bullshit, of, you know, the media ignoring or forgetting about or never even reporting on their story. Or situations like 100 youth arrested on January 7th, Mesherly not even arrested till January 13th. Mesherly, a guy who fled the city and has an arsenal of weapons, is let out on bail, where there are thousands and thousands of youth in jail today. They're refusing any sort of bail or relief. And, you know, I've seen analyses of the various pleadings that the district attorney has done on this. And, you know, in many ways, they've not only not charged the other officers, which is outrageous right then and there, but they've even accepted some of the prosecution's claims about this. I'd next like to bring up Rashida Grenage. Rashida is the wife of Raphael and the mother of Luke, both killed by the Oakland police on the night of December 15th, 1993, who's been fighting this ever since. Rashida.